as low as 1 ohm, as high as 1500 ohms, and everything in between. By those Brown and Woodward curves, you find out what length will give you what resistance. If for some crazy reason I want my antenna to be 167 ohms of resistive component, I take half that number, go to the Brown and Woodward curve. It'll tell me exactly what length will give me that resistance as a dipole. That's why I took half the number, because everything there is a 2-to-1 ratio, if you know what I mean. Pole versus dipole. And now I choose that exact length, I'll get that resistive component. Now, I will almost always have some reactance left over. And there's a zillion ways you can put in the inductor or the capacitor to kill the reactive component. The next question is going to be, do I get higher performance? Really, that means gain in efficiency. Let me drop this. As we set up a dipole in all of these crazy ways, bending down the ends, putting up top hat capacitors, zigzagging the dipole, winding the dipole on a great big tube of some kind, so it's a helical wind, putting inductors near the end, near the middle, near the beginning, right across the dipole. All of those antennas, as long as it arrives at an impedance that you're happy with, doesn't have to be 50 ohms resistance. I can make the impedance of that antenna 671 ohms or 15.5 ohms. And by way of the Berkeley equation, in other words, if I Google the word impedance match plus Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, beautiful website, where if you know the impedance of your antenna, and you can get that from the Brown and Woodward curve, or you can get it from your antenna analyzer, if I know the impedance of the antenna, and I plug it into the Berkeley curve, the Berkeley will tell you, ask you, what's the resistance and what's the reactance of your antenna, and what's the impedance of your transmitter, and you press go, and it will give you 15 solutions. Pi networks, L networks, upside down L networks, T networks, Pi T networks, Pi L networks. Choose the one that you like. It gives you the values. Gives you the schematic diagram. You set up that inductor and capacitor near the beginning of your antenna, and you will impedance match that antenna to any impedance you like, if you know what I mean. So you can force, by way of a very simple network, any antenna of any impedance. But now as you do all of this, let's call it detuning or retuning, let me drop it. The next piece of magic, which is very wrongly stated in a lot of good websites. There's a zillion websites that'll tell you the effective capture area of a dipole-like structure is a function of length squared. Absolutely wrong. Good sounding common sense. Lots of theory written that way. Dead wrong. The Bible on the subject is the Krauss book. John Krauss, W-H-A-K, who was the head of the Ohio University Electrical Engineering Department for a good number of years. He also formed the Electroscience Laboratory out there, a very high-class laboratory doing radio research. He wrote this book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, classic book. You go to the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. What John Krauss will tell you, from his measurements, as well as his theory, no matter how small you make the dipole, starting off at half wavelength and going down to anything you like, as small as you like, you can take an 80-meter dipole that's normally 132 feet long, and if you choose to, you can make it 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. You've removed 100 feet of the length of the wire. Let me drop. You do that, your resistive component that used to be 73 ohms for the whole dipole is probably going to go down to 8 ohms of resistive component, and the reactive component is probably going to be 2,000 ohms of capacitive reactance. But that's a definable impedance from the Brown and Woodward curve, and by the Berkeley equation, you can easily impedance match that. The infinitesimal dipole, once you have resonated it and impedance matched it, so to speak, with low-loss material. You've used a good inductor and a good transmitting-grade capacitor, so you don't get any loss, per se, in the inductor and the capacitor you've chosen. Once you've impedance-matched it with low-loss material, it comes back to the exact same effective capture area within half a dB. That's a crazy one. Here I'm building a dipole one quarter of a normal size, and it gives me the same capture area, the same gain, the same electrical engineering performance, the same efficiency. And the half a dB of gain that you lose is not a loss. The pattern, the figure eight pattern, became a little bit broader. That's where the extra half a dB went. The magic of resonance is that even though the thing is almost infinitesimal in size, as long as it's resonated with low loss materials, let me drop the call. Within half a dB, it'll give you the exact same gain. That's the good news. There's a piece of bad news here. You do all of that shrinking. The Q goes high. Q really means center frequency divided by bandwidth. Q also means voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, rise time and fall time, ring down time, rate of change of phase versus frequency, energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated. There's five or six definitions of Q. That really means there's five or six different ways of measuring it. It's the exact same phenomenon. Lots of stored energy. The equivalent of a big, heavy flywheel. It takes longer to put the energy into it, but once it gets rolling, boy, it's going to roll for a while. Same thing with your high Q antenna. It's going to have a longer rise time, and it's going to ring down for a longer period of time. It's got a lot of stored energy, but it's going to be bandwidth narrow. One of the definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. So your antenna on a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, maybe it was 200 kc wide before you had to retune your antenna tuner. Now you make this infinitesimal dipole, instead of it being 200 kc wide, maybe it's going to be 2 kc wide. Every time you QSY 2 kc, you're going to want to retune your antenna tuner. That's what happens with very high Q. But once you bring it back into resonance with low-loss materials, a low-loss broad-range antenna tuner, it'll give you the exact same gain, the exact same transmitting gain, the exact same receiving effective capture area. Of course that sounds crazy. Opposite of common sense. That's the magic of resonance. It's a little bit equivalent, and it's the best example I can give you on the job. My son swinging on a real high-quality swing, where I got good bearings at the top of the swing. I can push him with my hands, and in about five pushes, I've got him up to pretty high swinging magnitude. That's a low-Q circuit. I can decide to push him with my pinky, and I'm only pushing 1 ounce on each push. It's now going to take me 50 or 100 pushes to get him up to a good deflection. But if I spend the time doing it, I'll get him up to the exact same magnitude. That's a high-Q circuit, if you know what I mean. The forcing function is a very small force, and the losses with a good efficient set of bearings, and he's a aerodynamic guy, so to speak, not making very much wind resistance, it's a very high-Q circuit. It's very narrowband. By that I mean, if I push him a little bit too high in frequency so that I get out of phase, I'm not going to get very much swing out of him. It's a very narrowband circuit. Whereas if I'm using my two hands pushing him on his waist, I can push him I can make the swing move quite a bit faster in cycles per second. That's a low-Q circuit. So an antenna is a little bit like that. It becomes very narrowband if you squeeze it down in size. The voltage at the tips will go sky high if you carry the process too far. That 32-foot-long dipole, if I put a kilowatt into it, there's a chance I'm going to get some arcing voltage, some corona at the tips of that dipole. There are guys who have put an 80-meter monopole on their automobile, shrunk it down quite small, great big loading coil at the bottom, and as they talk into the microphone sideband, you can see the arcing at the tip of their monopole antenna on their automobile, and you can hear their voice in that arcing. Let me drop it. But as you can tell, no matter how you impedance match the antenna, no matter where you put the coils, no matter how you zigzag it, if it's a half-wave-like structure and smaller, you can easily have, with high-quality materials, very close to 100% efficiency, very close to the exact same gain within half a dB. That full-size 80-meter dipole on 3.75 megahertz, 132 feet long, 14-gauge wire. One of the bedrock equations of antennas is gain equals 4 pi Abel lambda squared. 4 pi, area effective over lambda squared. You can resolve the equation for area. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain equals lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug in the numbers for a full-size half-wave dipole on 80 meters. That area is 8,500 square feet. Let me drop. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked into that antenna broadside, you'd see this great big black oval in space, roughly 150 feet wide, roughly 50 feet high, is that oval. Any 80 meter signal horizontally polarized coming into that space, that black oval space, every bit of that gets absorbed, gets coupled onto that wire, goes down the feed line, and moves the signal strength meter on your receiver. When you squeeze it down to 100, instead of 132 feet long, it's only 30 feet long, and you re-resonate it, you'll have the exact same oval, the exact same area, within half a dB. 8,500 square feet will go to 8,000 square feet. It's still a damn good antenna. And except for the fact that it's narrowband, the guy that you talk to with it, he will never know that you made that change. You'll be equally as loud within half a dB, which is, one-tenth of a signal strength meter or S unit, one-tenth of an S unit. He'll never see the difference. And even that, because the pattern became a little bit broader, some of the guys that were in the know off the end are not in the know anymore, if you know what I mean. So common sense and dipoles sometimes doesn't make sense. Without you having real experience of building, using, and testing these things, some of it seems a little crazy at first. I don't blame you for being skeptical. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the deck pad.
KC2WGB. Well, sure, Dick. It looks like, you know, you put up an antenna that's 100 feet long. You collect X amount of energy. If you cut it in half, you get half the energy. That seems to follow very easily, and most people would follow that. So I could see this effort. It's going to be a tough one. But, well, thanks for the information. That's about it from the mailbag. And over to Paul, see if he's locating anything new. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
He said, is there anything new? With NASA, there's always something new. New measurements. They got a zillion satellites out there. Continuously making measurements. There's something new every hour of every day. We may not be able to read about it all, but Paul tries to read about it all. He tries to give us the best of that information. So what's NASA been doing in the last 7 days, Paul? What's going to blow our minds? WS2N, our space expert, K2IW TechNet. Go right ahead with what I think is space report number 168 of the series. You got it, Paul.
This is WS2N. Yes, Dick. And yes, I've been keeping track with the computers. We're up to 168. And I just came back in. I took another picture of the moon using my tablet. It's better than my digital camera. So it seems to do a lot better. Actually got a reddish color involved on the last one. So it's starting to look pretty good. It just got to the full point at 10:11. It'll stay like that, but I guess for about another hour. It'll start reversing at like 11:23, I think. But very good. You got to wait until 10:33 before the same type of thing comes up. But I don't see much of a difference between perigee and the apogee. I've seen lunar eclipses before. This one looks very good, of course. Excellent. No problem with the clouds. One important thing I want to mention for tomorrow, 11:30 a.m. I'm looking forward to a report from NASA. They're supposed to be making a major report, major finding, dealing with the exploration of Mars. I want to hear this. Going to be meeting at the James Webb Auditorium in Washington. And I intend on bringing up the NASA TV for that, see what they're thinking. Two operating rovers on Mars, Opportunity and Curiosity. I don't know if they found something, maybe something from the high-rise camera on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or one of the other many spacecraft that are in orbit around Mars. We'll have to see what their scientific finding that they're going to bring up at this meeting. Now, they've been talking about this like for 5 days, so this better be good. I can't imagine it being life on Mars. Neither rover has that capability of detecting anything. Actual organisms have it. So unless, a rabbit hops in front of one of the cameras, that's the only light detecting machines they have on board. That's going to change with the 2020 rover that they plan on launching. Very similar to Curiosity. That will have different kinds of instruments to actually detect living organisms. And in fact, the European Space Agency has a plan for sending a rover in that time frame at all. I think 2018 for the European Space Agency. They're sending a rover, and they plan on having equipment to actually detect, microorganisms. We'll see. We'll have to wait until tomorrow at 11:30. Got a Progress launch coming up on October 1st, a couple of days, to refeed the International Space Station. That's always interesting to see how they're going to make out. If we lost one back in there about 6 months ago, they've corrected all about that. They've had Progress launches, and they've had human launches. If that thing gets up to the space station, okay, you have right now a cargo vessel attached to the space station called the H2. That's attached by Japan. Japan put that up a couple months ago. They'll load it up with garbage, and eventually that will disconnect. They'll burn that up in the Pacific Ocean. Same with the Progress that's already up there now. That's got to go. That's going to go the same way. So we'll see how they do with those launches. Last week, you were curious about the cost of the Square, Square Killer Meter Array going to build in Australia and South Africa. And it's roughly about $2 billion to start construction in about a year or so. And probably end around 2020. They'll probably start detecting that stuff a little bit before that, as the antennas come online. But I plan on having arms, array, like the set of arms going after the center, 1,800 miles from the core. So it's going to take big money. Each one is going to be some 15 meters in diameter. I did find a picture of a car sitting next to one of them, so it's a big antenna, each one of them. They have a sensitivity about 50 times more than anything that we have now, and we'll see a tremendous amount of supercomputers are going to be hooked up to this thing. So talking about ET, looking for ET earlier in the net. This is kind of like the same type of thing. We've sent signals out on our antennas on Arecibo back in the early 1970s. They sent the message out. It's still going out there, but it's in 35 years or so. You're only going to get to 35 light years out. So it's possible that somebody on Vega 25 light years out received that. They're thinking about sending a message back, but we think we got a long wait. A couple of other launches coming up. One in 2016, and that's going to be the InSight mission. Interior exploration using seismic investigations. Geodesy heat transport. Big long word, but the InSight mission, and that's going to be one that's going to land on Mars. This one don't have any wheels. It's similar to the Phoenix mission that they did back in 07 that landed on Mars. And that one landed in the northern plains. That one found ice. In fact, that one found ice and then dug it up, saw ice. Next day they took a picture of it, and the ice was gone, so it evaporated. So this mission kind of looks like that. It's the same type of antennas, these big round, 15-foot diameter antennas. unfurl once it's on the air. Pick up about, you know, like a couple of thousand watts of electricity. Got a drill on board. All of that should be launched in March of this coming year. And the first time they're going to launch a interplanetary spacecraft from California. It's going to be launched from Vandenberg on an Atlas V. Atlas V is one of the bigger rockets that we have. Usually launched from Cape Canaveral. Being about the same weight of the Phoenix mission, you could have probably launched it on a Delta rocket from Cape Canaveral. That's the way they launched Phoenix. But they want the capability of launching from other locations. And the reason for it is that Atlas V primarily is launched from Florida. But there's so many missions, and the itinerary is really booked, and they really need to find other launch pads. California is available. So even so, it's usually easier for, you know, to launch something along the equator from Florida. Vandenberg, you can't do that. But because it's a much more powerful rocket using the Atlas V instead of the Delta, they can do that. They'll send it to almost a geo transfer orbit, and they'll be able to send it on its way to Mars. WS2N. A lot of spacecraft are up there. Maven is up there a year. Got up there about a week difference from India. India launched a spacecraft. It now has one around, going around Mars as well. Mars orbiting mission. And it turned out to be very successful. They were hoping to get 6 months. They've already got a year out of it, and they have enough fuel on board for many more years from that. Maven from our country is doing good, and MOM from India is doing so well that India is going to send another one up there. In another year or so, they plan on sending a MOM 2. So, you know, there's a country that's coming along. They've sent things into orbit around the moon. Now they're involved with Mars. They've done a test mission for a crew return vehicle, testing a heat shield out about a year or so ago. They eventually have plans on sending our crewed flights up from India. Like you said in the beginning, that there's a lot of things going on. It's just no end to it. Falcon 9 will be starting up again probably mid-November. They've recovered from their explosion that they had back in June. And with an upgraded spacecraft, yeah, about 20% more or so, probably a little bit more than that. More thrust, a little bit taller spacecraft, and rocket, rather. Things are moving along, little by little. Boeing's doing great. They're building their launch complex on launch comp.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Starting in 2017, the flights to the International Space Station. They now call it the Starliner. That's it for now, Dick. Anybody want to get in touch with me, my call letter at ARRL.net. Dick, over to you. Any questions, you or anybody else, I'll be here at WS2N.
Good stuff, Paul. Anybody have any further questions on anything to do with space? Miss your call letters right now. We'll have Paul answer it immediately. K2RIW listening.
I have a simple question, and to EO Dick.
You got it, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. Paul or Dick, maybe you can answer this. Originally, it was Cape Canaveral. Then they named it Cape Kennedy. Why did they go back to Cape Canaveral, Paul? I'm a little perplexed by that. Not an important thing. It's more, I'm just curious.
I'm going to make it.
We'll never mind to change that name. Cape Canaveral. It is a community down there, you know, private houses and everything, and people down there in swimming pools. And it's a, you know, it's just like living in Massapequa. I mean, it's an area called Cape Canaveral. And just north of Cape Canaveral, they have the Port Canaveral, where the big boats go out, with the cruises. And so it's a whole community, and they really wanted to keep it that, and they switched it back. The island itself, Merritt Island, that's filled with over 30, a little over 40 lunch complexes. Some are defunct, they don't use anymore, but a lot of them they're bringing back to life, and pretty much going to keep it that way. It's just a political move. They just wanted to keep it that way. Rich, back to you, Dick.
At what time, Paul, there was the Kennedy Space Center, primarily civilian, and there was Cape Canaveral, primarily military. At one time, nearby, there were two separate facilities with two separate names. Has that been merged, or do you think there are two facilities yet, Paul, in the Cape Canaveral / Kennedy Space Center area? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, when I was there in the 70s, went down to visit, it was Cape Kennedy, so in my mind, that place is still Cape Kennedy. So, the time frame that switched back, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years after that, probably in the 1980s, I guess. Don't remember, but I use words interchangeable, so we'll see how it goes. All these launch complexes are coming back, you know, there's a whole run of these things all along that shore, everything from one all the way up to I think 41. 41 is now going to be Boeing's. They're building there. There were BFD-100, see, now that's what I call it, but it's now called the Space Liner. Starliner is the name. So, they're building that one. Now you've got Blue Origin, they're taking over 36A. Got SpaceX, they're really good, doing good. They already control Launch Complex number 44, their flights, the ones that you see going up, including the ones to the International Space Station, as well as 39A, that's the one that went to the moon. They used that one to go to the moon. All the shuttle flights, so half the shuttle flights, it was a 39A and it was a 39B. So 39A is now going over to SpaceX for the Falcon 9 heavies. That'll be like 3 Falcon 9s bolted together. That'll be coming up probably with...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Complex number one. Yeah, it's called Launch Complex number 13. Now 13 is becoming Launch Complex number one. And that's now being operated. You know, all these different companies really renting these facilities out. You know, they have these 5 and 10 year leases. So SpaceX took a lease out for 5 years for Space Complex number 13, now they're going to call Launch Complex number one, and instead of rockets taking off, he plans on landing them there. He's going to have one main landing site, and then surrounding that one landing site, you know, in the same complex area, Launch Complex number one, there'll be four other landing, it's a little bit smaller than the main one, but four other places to land rockets. A lot going on in the commercial industry. It's just a lot more coming up, things I keep reading about. Dick, over to you.
So we got a lot of companies that are launching space hardware. Elon Musk, Boeing, SpaceX, and whatever. All of these companies with these nearby launch pads, where required, are almost all of those companies using the same NASA vertical assembly building, or in some cases are they doing the assembly right on the pad? I think that's quite difficult to set up a crane on the pad. So are they all using the same vertical assembly building, Paul, Over to you, K2RIW.
Back to vertical assembly, building will be for 39A, 39B, and even this is going to be now 39C for small rockets that will be launched by companies that I haven't even read yet, but NASA's already setting it up. If you want to launch a rocket with 200,000 pounds thrust and any kind of fuel, I mean, they're going to have different tanks for either liquid hydrogen or liquid natural gas, LNG, or, you know, for regular RP-1, which is nothing but kerosene. I mean, that's your most common rocket fuel. They're going to set up Launch Complex 39C, a new one. So you have 39A, which will be for the large Falcon 9, Falcon 9 Heavy, the one I mentioned before, with the three of them bolted together. You have Launch Complex 39B, and that will be the SLS rocket. That's the one NASA's building, your future Mars rocket, bigger than the Saturn V, all coming out of the vertical assembly building, which is the one that they used for strictly for the Saturn V's when they were built, and the Saturn 1Bs, and eventually they used them for the space shuttle. Now it's going to be multi-size rockets coming out of that vertical assembly building. And then Boeing has their own building that they're setting up near Launch Complex 41 for setting up their rockets. From what I understand, Blue Origin, they don't have any building set up, but they'll have to build one. They took out a...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
There's a lot of facilities down there. What's the other one? SpaceX launches their regular Falcon 9. See, that comes out of a different building. That doesn't come out of the vehicle assembly building. They're all too far away. You know, there's many miles along that Merritt Island, so they all can't come out of. They all can't come out of that one building.
Okay. That makes sense, because the building would be overbooked for all of these parallel operations, and the way you move something from the vertical assembly building to launch pad 39A, B, or C is by way of that crawler. They've only got one crawler and one vertical assembly building, so that would be a considerable conflict. Now, when it comes to the InSight mission, launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and I've been there. That's the base they often use when you're going to do a polar orbit, because there, to launch due north or due south, but primarily due north, is primarily an overwater path, because Vandenberg sticks out into the water. Therefore, as you drop various boosters, you're dropping them in the water as opposed to dropping them on uninhabitable areas. Let me drop. When you launch something that's going to go into a high-energy mission, to me, high-energy mission really is MEO or GEO, in other words, medium Earth orbit or geosynchronous Earth orbit, really high orbit, or launch to outer space. You'd like to launch something as close to the equator as possible, because at the equator you're moving more than 1,000 miles an hour, so the beginning speed, the first 1,000 miles an hour, is given to you free of charge by Earth rotation. Now, when you come up here to Kennedy Space Center, which I guess is at around 25 or so degrees north longitude, take the cosine of 90 degrees and multiply that by the 1,000 miles an hour, you're still getting 800 or 900 miles an hour. You're getting a great big boost to begin with. If I'm now launching something for a high-energy orbit, like going to Mars, I want to launch with as high a velocity as possible. The Earth is turning from west toward east. Therefore, even if I launch from Vandenberg, I'm going to want to launch the mission. As soon as it clears Vandenberg, I'm going to want to go to the east. Well, you go to the east from Vandenberg, and you're flying over habitable area. So now I see a conflict with this Vandenberg launch for a high-energy mission. sounds like you're going to be potentially dropping boosters over habitable areas. And there's no good way around that, that I know of. So give me some words on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and Fregnet.
Okay, and first of all, we have, you know, we own two of those crawlers. I mean, theoretically, we could have launched two shuttles at one time. In fact, that was planned at one time in case it had to be a wreck, you know, an emergency a rescue. So you had two crawlers. And Vandenberg, yeah, well, that's why they're using the Atlas V. Atlas V is much more powerful than the Delta, II. And Delta II launched the Phoenix spacecraft that landed on Mars. Basically the same bus, the same size, same weight is going to be the inside mission as Phoenix. The difference is you're launching on a much bigger rocket. Atlas V is the biggest one we have at the time, right now. So what they do is they need to do this because Atlas V is booked. In fact, there's another mission I think going up in another week or two, sending up a Mexican spacecraft or something, a communication by an Atlas V. So they're sending it out in California because they know everything's getting booked, and they need the diversity to be able to do that. So they're sending it up with a 4-meter fairing, by the way, instead of the normal 5-meter fairing that was used for New Horizons and for, Curiosity. But, you know, that's the diameter. So you don't even need as much room. They do need more power. They are doing what you're saying, and they're actually going to launch straight up and then south. Everything goes south. They don't go north on Vandenberg, otherwise everything would be over. It's all launching boosters over L.A., I guess. Well, actually, wait, Vandenberg is northwest of L.A., but they, you know what I mean, they'd be going over Montana or someplace. So they go south. But in this case, what they do is they launch to a very high altitude. It's kind of like throwing a ball up. And you throw it up as high as you want, straight up, and then eventually it gets to that point. It's kind of like going nowhere, you know. And at that point, they're able to reignite the upper stage of the Atlas, make sure it's pointing in the right direction, which will be, like you said, to the east, because, you know, you want to go from west to east. And that's how they're going to get their proper direction. But you do need more power for this. That's the plan. Back to you, Dan.
To leave the Vandenberg launch pad and go south, and therefore fly directly over the South Pole, or a so-called polar orbit, there, almost all of that launch is over water. But here you want to go to literally outer space. Therefore, you need the rotation of the Earth in your favor. By launch Atlas straight up and into the south, I'm not getting very much boost from Earth rotation. So when you go far enough south so that now any other multi-stages that you drop off of that spacecraft during the boost phase, I guess you're dropping them either in the Pacific Ocean or maybe in the Gulf of Mexico. You got to eventually go east, as I see it. You don't just fly straight out. Otherwise, you're not getting the boost of the Earth rotation. You're throwing away the 800 miles an hour that Vandenberg is moving to the east. So it sounds like a fairly expensive way to go to make sure that none of your stages are dropped away over land, if you want to take maximum benefit from the Earth rotation. I don't know the amount of boost power of an Atlas V. I'm going to guess it's a healthy 5 million pounds. The Apollo was, I think, 6.5 or so, or 7 million pounds on launch. Is Atlas around 5? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
I think it's just over 1 million. Each one is, there's two engines. Each one is over 500,000 pounds. I believe it's roughly 1 million. I'll have to check. But relative to a Saturn V, no, Saturn V was, that difference is the Falcon 9 is 1.2 million, and now with this upgraded one, it's going to be 1.5 million one on the next launch in November. And yeah, by the way, India launches to the south as well, so it's the same type of thing. They can't launch north, but they launch south. It's southeast, but it's generally south. And their orbit keeps increasing little by little until eventually they break Earth's orbit and they wind up going to Mars. So it's kind of like the same thing with us. I think it took India probably about five or six orbits before they broke orbit. You know, each time you go around, you relight the engine as you're going toward Mars. You know, you're becoming more and more elongated. Same thing with Vandenberg. So you get to the point where it's really far high up, you know, right before you start falling down again, and then you really give it one blast. I guess that engine doesn't come back. I'm not imagining that. The final engine on the Atlas V coming back.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But, oxygen engine. I don't think that comes back. Back to you, Dick.
Now, whether it be an Apollo mission or a Mars mission or any, I'm getting the impression almost all of these missions first go into an Earth-hawking orbit, but you check out the spacecraft and make sure everything is good, and then you eventually do the boost to the much further goal. But anything that you do north-south almost doesn't help. The altitude helps some, but the north-south direction is useless. One of the puzzles that I've given people in the past, I used to give out these physics puzzles, was your favorite launch facility launched your spacecraft in a beautiful polar orbit, and then you discover that, hey, that was supposed to be an equatorial orbit. So somebody says, well, we'll just use the steering jets and go from polar to equatorial, make a 90-degree turn. On the Earth, you use the wheels pressing against the ground, you turn the steering wheel, you got something to push against, and if the vehicle is going north and you want to steer it to the east, you can do it with an almost losing no energy in the process. Well, in space, you got nothing to push against. All the pushing is going to burn up rocket fuel. And it turns out, literally what you've got to do with a polar orbit, if you want it to be equatorial orbit, you have to literally stop all of the polar motion and reestablish equatorial motion. None of the polar motion does you any good. The altitude does you some good, but the majority of the energy of being in orbit is the tangential velocity in the direction you want to go. So as they launch this Atlas V from Vandenberg and they're going south, all of that boost to the south and velocity to the south does them very little good.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, looks like we're back on the air. I presume that very soon, after they clear the land to the south, they start aiming east. I'm presuming it's a fairly inclined orbit. There's no need to make the orbit exactly equatorial. So it's a fairly inclined orbit for the parking orbit by which they eventually make the final boost to go toward Mars. Is that approximately what happens, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's highly elongated. For instance, Russia, they can't come down to the equator, but yet they have plenty of satellites in geosynchronous orbit. They'll launch from Kazakhstan, which is, I think, around 55 degrees north, but just to get back to zero. Years ago they used to do these Molinar orbits. You know, that was the way they really started out. And with these, they'd hang in the sky for 11 straight hours. You have three spacecraft, and eventually you could have a 24-hour day and just keep switching from one spacecraft to the other. But they wanted to have geosynchronous orbits as well. You know, they have, 11 time zones they want to cover just for their own country. So they do the same thing. They launch due north, Martha's extremely elongated orbit, you know, a couple hundred miles above the surface on perigee. And in apogee, you'd go out to 23,000 miles. So this is extremely long orbit. They call it a geotransfer orbit. And so if you look at it, you know, the diagrams they show in the, when you look at that, what they're doing, it looks like it's going, you know, relative to the to Russia, to Kazakhstan, where it launched, it looks like this thing's going almost straight up. And it just gets all the way up to the 23,000 mile. It might take a long time to get there. And as it's getting there, it's slowing down to almost, you know, zero. And then there's this other rocket, this third booster, usually on the Soyuz rockets or Proton rockets. And they'll launch, you know, they'll have this thing based in...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over your 0 degree latitude. Basically over the equator. When you're at that point, 0 degree latitude and its highest point, they'll launch this rocket and they got themselves a geosynchronous orbit. Yeah, it's going to be less efficient than, you know, running an Ariane rocket from, you know, a couple degrees off the equator. But they do it practically.
When it comes to orbital maneuvers, a maneuver to make a plane of orbit change is an extremely inefficient maneuver. The component of your north-south when you want to make an equatorial orbit, any velocity you've got north-south does you zero good. Because when you finally establish that equatorial orbit, there is no north-south component. It's only an east-west component of velocity that puts you into that geosynchronous orbit. You waste a lot of power. The more I think about it, the Molinia orbits you talk about, yes, they were highly inclined, and they were made very elliptical, and they become sun-synchronous. In other words, the orbit slowly precesses, and it slowly precesses as the seasons progress, and it tracks. So in other words, it comes over the exact same spot in the Soviet Union at the apogee every day of the month, every day of the year, as the way the orbit precesses. When you choose just the right inclination, I think it's 63 degrees, just the right amount of ellipticity of orbit, great big numbers between the apogee and the perigee. So it hangs up there at high altitude for something like 11 hours at a time for each individual satellite, and whips around the backside of the Earth real fast and comes back and does it again. Very crafty orbit. So that really takes advantage of their Kazakhstan north latitude launch site. But for them to go equatorial, got to guess, Paul, as to how many geosynchronous orbits of the equator does the United States have versus the Soviet Union or Russia? I'll bet you Russia has a smaller percentage than we do. What would you call KQLAW?
Yeah, we do. I don't know if it's even... I mean, they've launched satellites for us in the Proton rocket. We have Terra, I think it's called Terra 4. I have to look it up, but this 80-foot diameter dish launched by a Proton rocket sitting over Western America. And when it comes to these, you know, when it comes to money, I mean, the Russians are launching stuff for us, we're launching stuff for them. It's unbelievable. You know, there's no Cold War or anything going on between any of these countries, except maybe China. And I think that's starting to break down as well. You know, when it comes to the space program, you know, Boeing building equipment for other countries, satellites. SpaceX just launched one for some, I don't know, what's the name of that country? Turkmenistan, I think it is, which is supposed to be a real brutal regime, you know. And they just launched a spacecraft for them about a year or two ago. So, I don't know, it's kind of like asking me about cars, you know. You buy a Honda, is it really, you know, a Japanese car? I mean, it's made, the one I bought is made in America. So, depends who's launching them. I would say, you know, we've got more of them, but I don't think Russia's too far behind. Back to you, Dick.
The most efficient place to launch for equatorial orbit, arguably is South America. Kourou, Guiana, I think it's pronounced. I wonder, has Russia ever used that launch site? Paul, what do you think?
No, I mean, if, you know, as far as Russia launching one of their rockets from there, no. European Space Agency has launched, satellites, if they're, they put one of theirs on board, I don't know, I'm sure they probably have. But, the launches are from the European Space Agency. Now, it's, you know, they've got three rockets that they're launching. Their heavy rocket is the Ariane 5 rocket. And that will be, for instance, the one launching the James Webb Space Telescope from French Guiana is the country. That's where the spaceport is set up. And that's the heavy lift rocket is... Ariane 5, you see it with two big, huge booster rockets attached to it. Very nice looking rocket. And then they have a very small rocket they started launching three years ago. But they have a small load rocket called the Vega. And that just launched one of the test vehicles for the European Space Agency to see if it could have... Will this test model be able to be like the space shuttle and eventually come down and do precise landing? And they succeeded with that. You know, they put it into the water, but now they have another plan to upgrade that. But that's a small grade rocket. And now the medium grade rocket, they buy, here we go again, they buy the Soyuz rockets from Russia, you know. All the rockets going up from Russia, there'll be Soyuz rockets or something called Rakat, or there's Proton rockets.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Cargo to the International Space Station and to Mir is the Soyuz rocket. Ariane 5 needed a medium-grade rocket. You know, they all like to have heavy ones, medium, and small one. And it's like China now. China's got all three now as well. But Ariane 5, European Space Agency needed something between the Ariane 5 and Vega. So they purchased, and they still are purchasing Soyuz rockets, the whole rocket, and they bring it over, and they just redo it to their own specifications. They make some major changes. But it's basically a Soyuz rocket. You'll see some launches going up from French Guiana using, from the European Space Agency, ESA, and they're launching these Soyuz rockets. Nothing to do with Russia. Like me going over there, buying it, and then me launching it. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, what's the approximate thrust of an Ariane 5 and the fact that that's going to launch James Webb? I would have guessed James Webb is going to come from Kennedy Space Center, so it's going to be launched from French Guiana, South America. So Ariane 5, roughly how many pounds of thrust?
I think they're close to 4 million. Again, I'll have to check. But they're big. They used to launch the ATV every year. The it doesn't stand for amateur TV. Automated transfer vehicle. That was their contribution, one of the contributions to the International Space Station. And that was a large vehicle. That was about, they carried at least three or four times the amount of payload or cargo than the Progress spacecraft did. Probably as much as the shuttle. So that was a heavy vehicle. And then they would launch them roughly once a year from 2007, and they just finished the last launch. I think that was earlier this year, probably January or something. And there's no more on the schedule. And I forgot how heavy that payload was, but that was a monster. And I would dock with the space station, and they would unload that for months. Back to you.
Mission for Paul. Yeah, John recognized. I got a quick question for you, Will Paul, and that is the space shuttle was essentially actually designed around the size and weight of the Hubble Space Telescope. That was the size of the cargo hold. Told us before, but I've forgotten. What is the weight of the Hubble Space Telescope as it was launched by shuttle? And was that the heaviest thing that the shuttle ever launched? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW, and pass it over to John.
I think it was 50,000 pounds. And these other modules, like the multi-purpose module that they just relocated on the space station, I think that was around 30,000 pounds. And the little heavier than that was the Japanese module. They were all big, and then, you know, they were being big punched by this, the space shuttle itself had to be put into orbit, so you needed a big boost on that. That's why the space shuttle system had 5.5 million pounds of thrust between the three RS-25 engines attached to the space shuttle and the two one thiocile big rocket solid booster engines that were attached to it as well. John, over to you. KC2WGB, WS2N.
KC2WGB. Paul, is James Webb the only one we have? Do we have a backup for it in case something goes wrong? And another question is, it's been in storage a while. Are they performing upgrades as the technology has been advancing? Anything that like that that you know of? Back to you, Paul. KC2WGB.
I think they're still building sections of that great big mirror. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I think the sections are pretty much done. 18 sections. Each one roughly about they're like six-sided mirrors, about a meter each, roughly 21-foot diameter hole setup. And then they have a secondary mirror, you know, right in the center of all these mirrors. And then a tertiary mirror, a third one. And I understand they're all built, and they're all built on a beryllium platform. The platform that they're built on is designed where, you know, between the hot and cold problems that, you can have in outer space, it won't move less than, I think it's one-tenth the distance of a human hair. The contracting and expansion rate of this whole beryllium setup frame, and they've tested it, and they're ongoing. Every time you read about this, they're testing another part. They put it in these big vacuum chambers, and they chill them down to ridiculous, you know, temperatures, like, you know, almost absolute zero temperatures. They shake them on shaking machines. All these different parts and 10 different pieces of instruments that will be attached to this thing. So as far as changing the technology as time goes on, I haven't heard that. This was designed years ago, and I guess they're sticking to it. Back to you, John.
And is that the only vehicle we have? We just have one of those. We didn't build two of them, right? There's no backup.
No backup. No, that's it. Just that Ariane 5 is such a good wreck. I mean, everything they launch. I mean, I think one time they couldn't get a secondary payload. One of their they call them Galileo satellites. The Galileo cluster of satellites that they have is, you know, all GPS, their system. They want their own system. They don't want to only just depend on using ours, although ours is used worldwide. One of their satellites had a little trouble getting to the proper orbit, but I think they corrected that over time. They just managed to use thrust as subject to, you know, to get back to the proper orbit. So, but they've launched, you know, like 70 different rockets from this French Guiana, and, you know, they're like all successful. And it was man-rated. They were going to put people on top of this thing at one time when it was designed. You know, there was an Ariane 3. There was no Ariane.